TED Audio Collective.
Hi, I'm Debbie Millman. Canva is great for designing visual content for work, no matter what industry or department you work in. Nail your next presentation with Canva Presentations. Start with a professionally designed template and use it as a springboard for your design. It's a serious time saver. Time to present but can't be there in person? Enter Canva Talking Presentations. Record yourself presenting and add your talking head to your slides so your audience can watch your perfected presentation anywhere, anytime. Start designing today at canva.com. Designed for work.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City Branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Politics is the push and pull of who we are and who we hope to be, I think. And I really felt like something weird was happening in this country.
All I ever want to do in my books is just show, for me, specifically Black children as human beings.
From the TED Audio Collective, this is Design Matters with Debbie Millman. For 18 years, Debbie Millman has been talking with designers and other creative people about what they do, how they got to be who they are, and what they're thinking about and working on. On this episode, to mark the end of 2022, we're going to hear excerpts from some of the best interviews with fiction writers that Debbie did in the past year.
Isn't this what we're all hungry for, is for somebody to drop the mask and really say what's on their heart and on their mind?
Over the 18 years I've been doing Design Matters, I've slowly expanded the range of people I interview. First designers, then people in the visual arts, and now pretty much anyone who is living a creative life. And that, of course, includes writers, especially writers of fiction. This year, I interviewed a number of remarkable writers. That means I read a lot of fiction and boned up on the biographies of the writers themselves. And I always want to know, how did they become the person who does what they do? To mark the end of 2022, I want to play excerpts from some of those interviews. First up, Brad Listy. Brad Listy is a novelist. He also hosts a podcast with other writers called The Other People Podcast. His latest novel is Be Brief and Tell Me Everything. One of my many questions for Brad was about a line in that book that is this: "The first half of my existence has been spent with only moderate success trying to become someone, and the back half would be spent learning to become no one." Talk a little bit more about what that means.
Well, I think it's just having a really acute sense of death, which I want to believe most of us have. I know I'm not alone in this. I think a lot of people are really death obsessed, and not in a bad way. I think it's healthy to comprehend your life through that lens. Like, it's coming. We are going to die. It could happen today. It could happen tomorrow. It will be the end of this incarnation, or the end period, you know, depending on your worldview or your spiritual framework. I am often at odds with cultural values for this reason. It can seem crazy to me. I think it seemed crazy to me in the phase of my life when I was trying to quote unquote become someone, which I'm not entirely divorced from. I mean, we all have to do what we have to do to get by in life. But I think maybe the grief experiences that I've lived through, these untimely losses, made me, you know, who I am in a lot of ways, and gave me that acute sensitivity and brought to mind all these big existential questions. Like, what's it all for? What are we doing here? I want to try to deeply reckon with my own mortality. And I don't want to use the phrase, I want to die well. A lot of people say that, like it's like an accomplishment. It's like, no, you know, like I'm sure it'll be messy and a little terrifying, but I do want to have courage and I do want to look at it because I'm fascinated by it. It's kind of the ultimate reality to me. And I don't think it has to be this kind of heavy, morbid albatross that you carry around. I think it can actually be a positive, even daily ritual that adds a sense of urgency to your existence and helps to put things in perspective and helps you to relate to the people in your life whom you care about the most at a level of depth that would otherwise not be there. You know, when you have a sense of like, wow, the clock is ticking. What matters most? Who matters most? It's these kinds of things, you know, it's like priority inducing. And so that's the way that I try to relate to it. And maybe I just have a deeper sense of it or a bigger fascination with it than most, but I know I'm not alone in it.
No, not at all. In thinking about the structure of the book, you stated that it required a lot of failure. And for example, there's a chapter in the book where you talk about a miscarriage, a single miscarriage that you and your wife experienced, even though you experienced multiple miscarriages, I believe 5 miscarriages, yes, which is just horrific. And you decided that that was too much. I think there was even a moment where you felt like the book could have been called, you know, The 5 Miscarriages.
right.
But you stated that when you go through all that failure, you start to get a more developed sense of the reader. How does that happen?
Well, some of it's feedback. Some of it's people in publishing telling you that the book is just too depressing or suffocating, where they're just, you know, they're not sparking to it. I think there's a temptation and a kind of reflexive, like a natural reflexive inclination for people who are writing what you would call it, a trauma or a grief narrative, to want to just render the experiences accurately and truthfully in full. And I tried that mode. The problem, even though the writing was probably pretty good on a line-by-line basis, is that that's not enough for a book to work. You know, I kind of knock myself on this front, you know, as maybe like a blind spot for me or an area that I could stand to improve, is having a more well-developed sense of the reader at the end of the line. If you're writing a book, you're writing for a reader. And sometimes I think you can be like, well, I'm writing this because I need to express myself.
Not a good reason.
No, you have something to say. That's a different task. You know, if you want to express yourself, get a diary. You know, you can express yourself all day long. But if you're trying to write a book, you're trying to communicate with somebody. And you have to have a sense of them. And it should be primary. And it took me a while to get there. There are little things about a book that make it more pleasant for a reader. Things move along. There's not a lot of wasted motion. There's a couple laughs here and there, even in a dark story. There's a sense of real intimacy and risk on the page, which causes people, myself included, to lean in. You know, I always appreciate that. You go, oh, okay, so here we go. You know, it's like that sense of somebody really dropping their guard and bringing you in and being willing to say what often goes unsaid. And I hope in subsequent books that the learning curve will not be so steep and will not take me as long.
That was Brad Listy. Jason Reynolds is the author of some of the most celebrated YA fiction of our time, including All American Boys and the best-selling Track series. He also writes comic books and poetry. Here's an exchange I had with Jason about his early days as a writer. When you were 16 years old, you self-published your first book, and you began selling it out of the trunk of your mother's car. Mm-hmm. Was that the book Let Me Speak?
That was, and it's so weird that you know this.
it wasn't that hard to find. Tell us what the book was about, and how did you make copies of it, and how did you go about selling it?
Back then, it was different. I was 15 when I started it, 16 when it came, when I was selling it. It goes back to my mother, you know, I can do anything. There was nothing in me that ever felt like I couldn't just make what I wanted to make or do what I wanted to do or go where I wanted to go or say what I wanted to say, right? I just never had any of that, any of those sort of hangups. And so I remember telling my mom, like, yo, I want to make a book. I'm gonna publish a book. And so at that point, I was all over the East Coast as a 16-year-old. This is when spoken word was becoming, it was still like an underground thing. It hadn't really exploded yet. We're talking about like 98, 99, around that time. And so it's about to explode, right? It's about to explode. It's still a thing that everybody's doing, but it hasn't hit like the mainstream. It's a bunch of just young, artsy, bohemian kids getting together at grimy open mics and just doing their thing, right? Everyone has on brown and green and smells like patchouli and that, right? Like that was sort of the vibe, you know? And I was one of the young people in that scene. And so I would be in Philly and I would be in DC and I would be in New York and I would be in Richmond and like as a 16-year-old, driving my mom's car, just getting busy. This is back when you can get a license at 16, obviously. And I'm just getting busy doing my thing because I knew who I wanted to be and what I wanted to do. And I realized that everywhere I went, they were all selling books, right? They're all in their 20s and 30s. They're all selling books. And so I'm like, I got to make a book too. I meet this woman in Baltimore. A good friend of mine still, Maisha Cherry, who at the time was 21, right? And she's like, yo, I started a publishing company and I'm going to publish like just our friends. And Maisha was the one who was like, I want to make this book with you. Let's do it. And really, it was a vanity press, right? Really, what that meant was Maisha was going to format it and put it in the files. And then I was going to pay for it to be printed up, right? And she was going to take care of the ISP.
That's pretty ambitious for a 15-year-old, a publishing company, your own imprint.
Yeah, that's what it was. And I was like, let's do it. And so we did that. I had a summer job. I remember, I think it cost me $500 to print 1,000 books. Books or 500 books or something like that.
Were they like Xeroxed and stapled? Did you have them bound? And
no, this was like a real deal. Like I found a printer. We found a printer out of Florida called Whitehall Publishing or something like that. They're out of business now. And they were just a family business that did actual like bound books. I paid them $500. They sent me 1,000 books and I sold them out of the trunk of my mom's car. And that's how I started to make money. And I did that a few times over, right? That was the beginning of my life as a bookmaker.
It's incredible that you did that. Do you still have copies of this?
I do. My mom has like 3 or 4. I have one around the house somewhere. My mom has one of the poems on the wall in the house because she's my mom, right? I try not to look at it. It's juvenilia, you know? It's hard to read some of that stuff.
But it's evidence. It's evidence of your being 15 and the ambition to publish and create this, it's extraordinary.
I mean, I think it's the first brick in whatever castle I'm building. And I look at it as sort of, this is the sign of a kid hungry for life, right? Somebody with a lot of grit, a lot of sort of persistence. Like nobody was going to tell that kid that he couldn't do anything.
Yeah, I believe you self-published 2 books.
Three books.
Okay. You went to the University of Maryland, and yet you almost failed out of college in your freshman year.
I did. I mean, it's tricky. I come out of high school, even with those great teachers, you know, Ms. Blaufuss and Mr. Williams, but I wasn't prepared for college. I'm 16 years old.
That's young.
Yeah. I'm not quite firm in my education. I don't really know too much because I wasn't that great of a high school student, right? It's not like I was, you know, a straight A kid or anything like that. I wasn't in an honor society or any of that kind of stuff. I was.
No, you were a publisher.
I was doing that part, but I was a get by kind of kid when it came to school. And I get to college, and the first class is English 101, and I bomb it, right? I fail it terribly. I fail it a few times. Not only am I failing English, but I'm failing math, and I'm in remedial. I'm in like pre-remedial, right? So this isn't like math 101. This is like the math you have to take before you get to math 101, right? And I'm failing that too, right? And so it was clear after my first semester that college was going to be a struggle for me, that I was in over my head, that I wasn't prepared for this, for whatever that world was, that kind of academic world. I just wasn't ready for it. But what I was ready for was the social element. I was ready to attack the world and attack this sort of bubbled space, this bubbled environment where I could literally build an ecosystem, right? That made more sense to me than classwork. That made more sense to me than tests and examinations or transcripts, right? I understood that all of the currency was outside of the classroom in a contained ecosystem that I could sort of like scrap my way to the top of whatever the hierarchy was using this grit that like caused me to make these books or, you know, run up and down the East Coast as a child reciting poems in rooms full of 30-year-olds, right? Whatever that was, it was going to be sort of exacerbated and pushed to the extreme on that college campus. And that's what I really used college for.
That was Jason Reynolds. Am Holmes is a prolific writer who often explores extremely uncomfortable situations and characters in her fiction. Her best-selling memoir, The Mistress's Daughter, is about meeting her birth mother when she was in her 30s. Her latest novel is titled The Unfolding, and it's about a white man who sees the election of America's first black president as a crisis for his kind. I asked her why she wanted to write a political novel. Why politics?
Why politics? Because politics is history, politics is culture, politics is the push and pull of who we are and who we hope to be, I think. And I really felt like something weird was happening in this country. I started this book well before Trump was elected, and I felt like not only had the American sort of political establishment lost touch with the average American, but that this new thing, which isn't really that new, but dark money was starting to flow in increasingly large amounts. And so I think part of it, too, is the exponential increase in that dark money and in think tanks and institutes and ways in which one buys airtime for a narrative that may not, you know, may not even be true. I mean, it's very complicated. But that was progressively more and more disturbing to me. And so I felt like I needed to kind of figure out how to talk about it. And also I felt like, you know, it's two different threads. So one thread is that I feel like when there was a previous election where I went to bed thinking Al Gore had won, and I woke up and George Bush was president. I was like, I missed something while I was sleeping, which for a person who's a worrier, it's a good way to get insomnia. Like, don't turn the news off, stay awake. But that, you know, was in a way happened because of, and I made it a person, not in the book, but in my imagination, Hanging Chad, who is not a person, but a thing in Florida. And because the Republicans had control over Florida, they were able to actually claim that the presidential election. And somehow there wasn't enough of a fight for that, which is a whole other problem. But so when Obama wins and they don't have another trick that they can pull out, this group of men becomes really disturbed. And what you begin to see is what I would describe of the fear of older white men, that they are losing power, they are losing all of the things that they took to be theirs and theirs alone, and they're going to now have to share all that. And I think that Obama's election unleashed a kind of racism and sexism that's always been there. I mean, we know that. But it kind of, almost in some bizarre way, gave it permission to surface all the more. And I think we're still progressively seeing that. So that's sort of why I chose that moment. And also because that moment was so powerful on the other side for many of us. You know, I bought a new TV. It was my first TV since college. And I got like a bigger TV to have people over to watch. And that difference between people taking to the streets, celebrating the idea that we could live in a different kind of a country where many points of view, many voices could be heard and so on. And then the sheer terror that evoked in white people. I mean, that's the only way I can describe it, you know, was interesting to me.
One of the most fascinating aspects of the book is how you weave these sort of fictive characters with real characters. John McCain, George Bush, Condoleezza Rice makes an appearance. And you refer to figures such as Malcolm Moose, who wrote President Eisenhower's military-industrial complex speech in 1961, I think. And I actually quite inadvertently learned a lot about history reading your book while I was mesmerized by the plot. How much research into American political history did you have to do, or did you already know everything that you were writing about?
I definitely did not already know all of it. I mean, I have to say, I have progressively fallen more and more in love with history. And I would call it histories, because that's one of the big things that also is, as I like to say, in my craw, that, you know, that we tend to think there is an American history. And then 5 seconds later, if you just even look at it, you realize there are so many histories that are not included. And that's really important to me as well. But so I did do a ton of research, and I've always been obsessed with the period that really begins with Eisenhower's speech about the rise of the military-industrial complex, because that's part of how we economically got from there to here. So that's really important. And this book is, I mean, I'm glad you got all that, because it is truly rolling in history and detail and crazy, crazy facts that you just think that couldn't be real, but it is. And I wanted to sort of play that history out and unpack it, you know, in line with these fictional characters who obviously are not historical figures, but in some ways represent elements of history in the sense that one of them will come from the world of banking, one of them comes from the world of medicine and business, which was an echo of the Eisenhower 10, which were the men that Eisenhower just sent lovely letters to saying, and in case of nuclear disaster, you will be in charge of agriculture. So as though, please show this letter to your nearest farmer and he'll know to give you his crops. I mean, I don't know how that was really going to work, but I found all of it really interesting and wanted to work with it.
You've said that your biological father was a bit big guy-ish and in that sense of a large-scale confidence and ownership, sense of ownership or privilege of place.
Yeah.
Some other familiar themes in your autobiographical writing return in the unfolding. Megan's parents lose their infant son to an illness before she's born. And then there's another big plot surprise that I don't want to give away. What made you decide to bring these themes into this book?
I think so many things. On the one hand, I would say I wanted to explore some of those themes a little bit more. And I still haven't really done it in terms of the sort of the law, what does it mean to me to be a replacement child, or what is that experience like? I at some point, maybe we'll write some more autobiographic material about that. But I wanted to explore that a bit more. Also, in my adoptive family, my father was quite politically radical. So in some ways, I have these two very, very different fathers. You know, he was a lover of Ramparts magazine and, you know, marching on Washington. And there's a, you know, a wonderful little FBI file on him for his early, you know, political work and so on. And so he also had, you know, all kinds of political books around the house, but it would be like Eldridge Cleaver's Soul on Ice, which I have his copy of here, and the report of the Warren Commission and all kinds of early nutball books about conspiracy theories and so on. So there's that juxtaposition. And my biological father was definitely sort of a big guy in Washington. That was, I mean, I didn't know, of course, that he, you know, the family had owned Washington, but he grew up there. He lived there. And there is a Washington within Washington, which is sort of the local people who are, can be sort of a little bit like fixers. You know, they own the parking lots, they own the land, they own the real estate and so on. And he was definitely a part of that group of men.
That was A.M. Holmes. Hi, I'm Debbie Millman. Canva is great for designing visual content for work, no matter what industry or department you work in. Nail your next presentation with Canva Presentations. Start with a professionally designed template and use it as a springboard for your design. It's a serious time saver. Time to present but can't be there in person? Enter Canva Talking Presentations. Record yourself presenting and add your talking head to your slides so your audience can watch your perfected presentation anywhere, anytime. Start designing today at canva.com, designed for work. Candace Carty Williams burst on the literary scene several years ago with her novel Queenie, which is about a young Jamaican British woman in London trying to recover from a bad breakup. Her new novel is called People Person. For this episode, my partner Roxane Gay guest hosted and conducted the conversation with Candace.
You've spoken very openly and eloquently about childhood trauma and dealing with anxiety and also getting healthcare through therapy. What prompts you to be open about the kinds of things that we tend to try and keep to ourselves instinctively?
I suffered so much when I was young with being like this sort of strong Black woman. And I just wanted someone to be like, I'm not. That's all I wanted. I just wanted one person to be like, I'm not that strong. And I never had that. And I was seeking it for years and years, not in my family, not around my friends, not on social media. And so I made a decision, I guess, when I kind of had any sort of public profile to be someone who was like, I'm not a strong Black woman at all. And that's fine, because I'm sure there is someone out there who's going to be like, well, great, neither am I. Mm-hmm. And also it's kind of like, this is a very strange, you've seen 8 Mile, I imagine.
Yes, I have.
And I think like you kind of just like Eminem does at the end, Rabbit, you kind of just got to say the stuff people might say about you up front, because like you're just gonna, there's nothing I'm ashamed of. You know, in my bio it says that I'm the product of an affair. That's true. And I had this idea of a journalist kind of being like, oh, so your parents, were they together? And me having to be like, oh, and maybe someone finding out that, you know. And I was like, no, I'm never going to have anything that anyone can use against me. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's two things. It's kind of like, I don't know, I think also just like, I'm a person in the world, I'm not perfect, I have many flaws, I'm trying to work them out, as we say, I'm trying to be kind as I do it, but there's nothing about myself that I'm ashamed of or embarrassed of, and I don't think anyone should be, because like I honestly think so many of us are just trying to get through the day. Mm-hmm. And so I think like this idea that I am strong, or that I am impermeable, or that I'm the best, or that I can do everything that other people can't do, it's just not real. And so I think like just say it, because like we're all just figuring it out, you know. And that might sound naive or quite silly, but we just are. Everyone is just trying every day to deal with something.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't sound naive. To my mind, it sounds realistic.
Yeah.
Because it's the truth. And sometimes the truth is just plain and simple. You were raised in South London, and you've said that you're going to always live there.
Yes.
What makes South London home to you? And what holds you to that place?
That is a really beautiful question. For my heart, South London feels very safe to me. I think because I've been there a lot, but also because I'm quite a sad person, which is fine. And in a way that I'm cool with that. Like, it's cool. I can have a laugh and like, I'm funny, but like naturally the emotion is sad. And I've spent a lot of years walking around South London, being sad, listening to music, walking around parks, all times of night, all times of day. And I've always felt very held still, always, by this space that's always looked after me. It feels very consistent, and it is the most consistent thing in my life. I've moved around a lot. I worked out that I've lived in like 25 houses when I was like growing up, and they were all in South London, and I always felt okay because I knew that I was going to be in this place that I understood. And so for me, it's that, and it's the nostalgia of always walking around this place and always feeling okay and always knowing I was going to be safe. And I always was, and I hope that I continue to be, but I've always been safe and held by that particular area, which is very interesting. I don't know if many people have that, but I know it and I long for it, you know? Mm-hmm.
Safety, I think, like kindness, can be underrated.
Yes.
I think it can be overrated in certain contexts, but I also think, especially for Black women, it can be incredibly underrated. And when we do find places and spaces that are safe, they are invaluable because there are so few of them, quite frankly. Mm. Before you were a writer, you worked in publishing quite a lot. And when I met you, I think you were still at Fourth Estate. Mm-hmm. I know that being Black and publishing in the United States is challenging because there are very few people in publishing editorially, as agents, as marketing executives, which is where you were. How did you navigate publishing as a Black Briton?
How do I answer this question diplomatically? In my first job, I had a really fun time. Fourth Estate was really amazing to me. I was able to start the short story prize with The Guardian for underrepresented writers. That was incredible. And that was me being like, I have an idea, I have a plan. And then being like, okay, do it, enjoy yourself. You know, if you need us, we're here, you can chat to us. That was incredible. And so I had a really good time there. But I think because I was 25, and I was sort of just like running around, just drunk all the time, just doing stuff I shouldn't have been doing, that was okay. And publishing kind of understood me as like as a young person. And so most of the seniors would say to me and my friend who I worked with at the time, my best friend, they'd be like, oh, hey, kids. And that was cool. And then I went into my next job and it wasn't good at all. Mm-hmm. It was really, I felt the weight of being the only Black woman there. There were many, many incidents that I found very, very tough. And I would have loved to have stayed on and carried on working in publishing, because I know that when you have someone Black or someone of color working somewhere, it makes a massive difference to what is published, even if it's one person, mm-hmm. because it just takes one person to stand up and be like, I can see how this book would sell. I can see why it's important. But I had to go. I had to go. And for many reasons that basically they paid me off in it. But one day I reckon I'll talk about it and give them their money back. But like, I had to go. I had to leave because I was like, it's killing me. It's killing me. Mm-hmm. It's killing me being here. The weight of that is hard. And I'm a very resilient person. I always have been. I can do a lot. I can feel a lot and I can cope with it. But that place, I was like, I don't think I'm going to make it out alive. And so I had to go. Mm-hmm. And I think writing a novel, I was asked by Human Resources, did you get permission to do that from your boss? And I was like, oh, okay, it begins. And so, yeah, it was a time.
I have to say, every time I talk to a Black person in publishing, I hear a story. And I think I'm never going to hear anything more fucked up than this.
Yeah.
And then I talk to someone else and I hear something worse. Yeah. And I think, okay, this is it. This is the apex. I'm not going to hear anything worse. Mm-hmm. When you're asked, did you ask for permission to write? That harkens back to so many white supremacist activities like enslavement. Are you kidding
me? Mm-hmm. I mean, I laughed. I laughed because it was a joke. And I was met with just a very straight face. And I was like, oh, that's not a joke. You're serious. And I was like, no, of course not. And at that point, I was so kind of like, oh, should I have? But I was, even then, I was like, this isn't right. That's not right.
No, it's not. It's curious to see the ways in which employers tend to think that because we work for them for 8 hours a day or so, that they have ownership over all 24 of our daily hours, when such is not the case.
Absolutely not.
That was Candace Carty-Williams with Roxane Gay doing the interviewing. Min-Jin Lee is an author and journalist who was born in Korea, grew up in Queens, and now lives in Harlem. Her latest novel is Pachinko, which is about several generations of a poor Korean family living in 20th century Japan. I asked her about that book, as well as her earlier novels.
So your first published book was Free Food for Millionaires, but the first book you wrote was called Revival of the Senses, which you didn't publish. And you've said this about that book. It was so boring. Really competent prose, but so, so boring. And you go on to state that even your husband said it's really boring and he's one of the nicest people on the planet. Did you ever try to have it published? Did you ever solicit any other opinions besides yours and your husband's?
Oh, yeah. I finally got an agent who I don't have anymore. This very nice young person who decided, I'll take a shot at you. And she sent it out and it was rejected everywhere. Absolutely everywhere. I have the letters. And no one said it was for them. I mean, not a single publisher. And she must have sent it out to at least 20 places. And I'm so glad it wasn't published. Now I see what happens if you have a terrible first publication. Like, I really understand what that means. So now I think, oh, I'm really glad that didn't happen. And it's okay that I was not an early success. Although, of course, I have to tell you that between the years of 1995 and 2006, every year, I really felt more and more like, oh, I've made a very big mistake.
After Revival of the Senses, you wrote the book Motherland, mm-hmm. which was a precursor to Pachinko. Mm-hmm. But you stated that that was garbage.
It was garbage.
Like, that was the word you used. It was garbage. Really?
Yeah, it was garbage because it was really boring. Again, it was really boring. And I think that this is, if I really think about the evolution of my writing, it's really about my inability to understand what it means to be an artist.
What do you mean?
And I take that quite seriously. When I say that, I don't think I understood about vulnerability. I didn't understand the risk that you need to take in order to really make a mark in the world of what you want to say and to stand in your position of what you believe. I thought I could lean on my competence, lean on my ability to do things in a very acceptable, admirable way. And I think being admirable and being competent is very different than being an artist. It's almost like the difference between being pretty and being beautiful. It's like a really different level of vulnerability and exposure. And I think by the time I published Previous Millionaires, I really decided that, you know what, it doesn't matter. I'm going to write things that could get me judged.
Your opening line of the book is competence can be a curse. It makes sense now. Now I see the little threads all coming together. What was the most irrational thing about writing Free Food for Millionaires?
That it took 12 years. And I wrote it in omniscient point of view, which almost no one does anymore. It's considered passé, or it was something that it's actually really difficult to do. And at certain points, what the modernists said in terms of the literary artists, that you didn't need to do it anymore because you need to be more psychological penetration of just one character and third person limited. It was also a rejection of the idea that since God is dead, you don't have this all-knowing narrator anymore. And I said, you know what? I still really love Anna Karenina. I still love House of Mirth. I still love Middlemarch, and I want to write like that. And I think that my decision to learn how to do that craft took such a long time, but I didn't know that that's what I was doing. I knew that I wanted to learn how to do this thing, but I didn't realize that it would take this long, and I didn't know that I would be so alone. And I don't have a training in the classic way. I don't have an English major. I didn't major in English, that is. I don't have an MFA. I don't have a PhD in literature. All of it, I had to figure it out by myself. And I'm glad I did now, but back then, I think I was just, I had a very DIY art career.
The interesting thing about this omniscient voice is, I think when you write this way, you have to ask yourself about this sort of fictional universe that you're creating. I think a lot of your work is, in its core, very much about morals and choice. I think you're crafting sort of a glacier through the choices that we face, whether we're adhering to a moral, just God or an immoral God.
Yeah, I am creating this world in which there's meaning, that I am arguing deeply against a postmodern world. I am arguing against the sense that there is no meaning, that things can just take place in terms of a Darwinian cycle. I'm fighting deeply against that. And in order to share that philosophy, I create these worlds in which there's a purpose and there's a good purpose.
Does your art have to reflect the sort of moral justice that you believe in?
I think so, without it being propaganda. Like, I don't ever want it to be irrational. Like, I don't really believe in these sort of Hollywood endings. Mm. I think that in a way, when we get these Hollywood endings very often, now we have two kinds of Hollywood endings. One is super happy and everything is saccharine, and the other one is the evil guy actually has to have sympathy. Lately, we don't seem to have anything sort of in the middle, and I guess I'm critical of both.
That was Min Jin Lee. These excerpts are from some of the fiction writers I interviewed in 2022. Next week, we'll have excerpts from interviews I conducted in 2022 with musicians and performers. Then we'll be back with brand new episodes with guests including the legendary athlete Megan Rapinoe, musician King Princess, restaurateur Will Gadara, scientist and writer Alexandra Horowitz, tech innovator Guy Kawasaki, artist Dario Calmes, and many more. This is the 18th year I've been doing Design Matters, and I'd like to thank you for listening. And remember, we can talk about making a difference, we can make a difference, or we can do both. I'm Debbie Millman, and I look forward to talking with you again soon.
Design Matters is produced for the TED Audio Collective by Curtis Fox Productions. The interviews are usually recorded at the Masters in Branding program at the School of Visual Arts in New York City, the first and longest-running branding program in the world. The editor-in-chief of Design Matters Media is Emily Weiland.